So let's start. Good morning. First of all, let me apologize for this delay. The previous press conference just finished and we needed to reboot the machines. And now we are online for the press briefing, the regular press briefing of the UN Information Service in Geneva. Today is Friday, 24th of April, and I would immediately like to go to the colleagues from UNICEF, World Food Programme, and Food Agriculture Organization, who are going to present us, we're going to launch the Global Report on Food Crisis 2026, which is releasing today, just after they have spoken at 11 o'clock. We have with us, and it's a real pleasure and an honor to have with us, Beth Bechtol, who is the FAO Deputy Director General. Welcome, Madam. Jean-Martin Bauer, I don't need to introduce you to Jean-Martin, the WFP Director of Food Security, and Ricardo Pires, our UNICEF Deputy Spokesperson in Geneva for UNICEF, as I said. So I'll start by giving the floor. I don't know if Mrs. Bechtol, you want to start?
Yes, please.
Please go ahead. I know that all, the three good. Of you have got very little time, so let's make it great. Go ahead.
Very good. Thanks very much, and good morning, everyone. We know it is a very busy news day for all of you, but I am pleased to be with you representing FAO and alongside WFP and UNICEF colleagues as we launch the 10th edition of the Global Report on Food Crises, actually here in London, in person with our friends from FCDO and ODI hosting. This report reflects a decade of consensus-based multi-agency analysis under the Global Network Against Food Crises, with 18 partners contributing data, analysis, and review. And I think that's what makes this global report in this moment in time so important. It's a neutral, jointly validated reference point that ultimately is in place to help decision makers focus on where needs are most severe and most persistent. I'll go to the bottom line and let colleagues sort of fill in with some of the very, I think, notable data and analytical points. But the bottom line message of the year's report is quite clear. Acute food insecurity is not improving. It is becoming more entrenched, more concentrated, and more predictable. In 2025, the year that the report covers, 266 million people faced high levels of acute food insecurity across 47 countries, levels that sadly have remained consistently high and nearly doubled compared to a decade ago. More than 80% of those affected are in protracted crises, and the burden is increasingly concentrated in a small number of countries, including Nigeria, DRC, and Sudan. We are also seeing a deepening of severity. Around 39 million people are now in emergency or IPC4 conditions, with major increases in countries such as Afghanistan, DRC, Myanmar, Gaza, and Yemen. But as I wrap up, let me also draw your attention to another group of individuals that needs our attention. Nearly 370 million people are in stressed conditions, IPC2. One shock away from crisis. And if we fail to support them early, they will become the next wave of need. It is also really important to note, as some of you who are looking at the numbers will see, that the decline in total numbers compared to last year's 295 million persons does not reflect improvement, but reduced data coverage and limited surveying on the ground, which masks the true scale of need. So as I close, let me just again say that the report highlights, I think, a very simple reality. These are protracted crises, and they require different ways of working and financing. So for you, I hope that the message from the report is not just about scale, but is also about trajectory. We are not keeping pace with how food crises are evolving, and unless we act earlier and differently, we will continue to see the same crises deepen and repeat. Let me, with that, turn over to Jean-Martin and Ricardo for their perspectives and additional insights on the report. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam, and thanks for this very, very clear message, Jean-Martin. It's a pleasure to have you here. Bonjour.
Bonjour. I'd like to follow up from Beth's inspiring message. and get into some other detail. The message we have for you today is a message of concern. 10 years of data on acute food insecurity is showing us that unfortunately, as Beth said, we're not keeping pace with increasing acute food insecurity worldwide. I'd like to highlight a few key statistics. In 2025, and the report goes into some detail about this, for the first time, there were two famines confirmed in the world, one in Sudan and one in Gaza. This shows that the situation is getting more severe, that food aid needs are becoming more severe. The number of people in IPC5, so this is the again, the highest level in the 5-point scale that we use to monitor and analyze food security worldwide, that number has increased by a factor of 9 in the past 10 years, reaching 1.4 million in 2025. Again, quite a matter of concern for us. And as Beth said, food insecurity is becoming more entrenched. And of all the countries that are analyzed in this report, you have 47 for which we have data, 33 of these countries have been in the report every single year. And this calls for a thinking around the investments that are needed to avoid this and the investments needed to get out of recurring food crises. So the asks that we have for the public are really around three different themes. Number one, access to data. Without data, we're not able to deal with this predictable and preventable problem that is hunger. We need access in the world's most vulnerable communities. And finally, we need funding. Remind you in closing that hunger is preventable. It's something that we can do. And hopefully this report equips us with the knowledge, with the data that we need to take on this task. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. Ricardo?
Good morning, bonjour. Thanks, colleagues, for your briefings. I'll try and be short. From a children's perspective, and the findings of the report shows that in 2005, an estimated 35.5 million children under the age of 5 were acutely malnourished across 23 affected countries. Nearly 10 million of these children are suffering from severe wasting, a condition that is life-threatening, but entirely preventable and treatable. Children with severe wasting are too thin for their height, their immune systems weaken to the extent that ordinary childhood illnesses can become fatal, and their risk of dying increases by 12 times compared with well-nourished children. At the same time, 9.2 million pregnant and breastfeeding women were acutely malnourished last year. When women cannot meet their own nutrition needs, their babies face a higher risk of low birth weight, illness, and death. This from the very start of their lives. Last year, for the first time, as was mentioned by colleagues, in two decades, we had two famines declared at the same time in Gaza and Sudan. In both contexts, children experienced far more than hunger. They faced the collapse of health, nutrition, and water systems, severe disease outbreaks, and extreme constraints on humanitarian access. In Gaza, the report notes on the fastest deterioration in child nutrition ever recorded, with the number of acutely malnourished children more than doubling in a matter of months. These are not just numbers, these are young lives. I was there personally on mission exactly when famine was declared in Gaza in 2025. What I saw inside health facilities is something I will never forget. Clinics were overflowing, corridors, waiting rooms, even stairwells filled with mothers and fathers clutching children whose bodies had been hollowed by hunger. I met infants too weak to cry, their skin stretched thin over fragile bones. Nurses weighing them again and again, hoping for a sign of improvement that rarely came. Parents were pleading, not for comfort, but for the simplest things, a sachet of therapeutic food, clean water, a chance for their children to survive. Health workers were doing everything they could, working without pause, but they were overwhelmed, short of supplies, short of space, short of time. This is what famine looks like in real life, not statistics, but a slow, visible collapse of childhood, unfolding in overcrowded rooms where hope is rationed alongside food. In Sudan, famine was confirmed in areas where families were trapped, services had broken down, and children were increasingly cut off from life-saving care. As you know, these are not isolated cases. Four places, Gaza, Sudan, Myanmar, and South Sudan, are classified as facing severe nutrition crises, where children are exposed to a deadly convergence of poor diets, high disease burden, and their lack of basic services. These are not inevitable again. They are the result of choices. Across most nutrition crises in the report, acute malnutrition is driven not by food shortages alone, but by the simultaneous failure of ensuring safe, unimpeded humanitarian access to food, healthcare, nutrition services and supplies, and of course, safe water. This is why children are becoming dangerously malnourished, even where food is actually available. The outlook for 2026 is deeply worrying. Rising conflict, climate shocks, and global market disruption threaten to push more children into acute malnutrition, just as nutrition services are being scaled back and access is becoming more restricted. For children, timing is everything. A child with severe acute malnutrition can die in weeks. With timely treatment, they can survive and recover. We've seen it happen over and over. But the growing risk of famine requires investing in prevention in addition to treatment for children. UNICEF's message is clear. Famine prevention must start earlier, before children reach the brink of death. We must invest in systems that enable early warnings. Response efforts must prioritize multi-sectorial life-saving action combined with sustained political, diplomatic, and operational action to prevent further deterioration and to secure safe, unimpeded humanitarian access again. And children, pregnant women, and breastfeeding mothers must be at the center of prevention and response efforts that link nutrition with health, water, sanitation, and social protection programs. Colleagues, finally, this report is also a warning on data. Early warning enables early action. Yet, nutrition data systems themselves are under threat from funding cuts and access constraints. Protecting these systems is essential to saving lives. If we fail to act now, the cost will be counted not just in reports, but in children's lives and their lost futures. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the three speakers. I think we still have a little bit of time for questions, if any, in the room. Let me see if there are hands up. Or online. Let me see. I don't see any hand up, but there is a question about the distribution of the material. I don't know who can help us with this. Maybe I look at the colleagues from the three organizations which are connected to make sure that the journalists have got the access to the whole report. Yes, Nina Larsson, AFP.
Sorry, on that, I was just wondering, this report, I think, was supposed to be embargoed until 11. Is it now? Has the embargo been lifted, I guess?
That is what I understand, but I'll ask confirmation to my colleagues of the three agencies. I don't know who wants to answer, Nina, on that. I don't know if Jean-Martin, Ricardo, or... Okay, so I have an answer here from the World Food Programme that the press release is coming out in 12 minutes with the report.
But can we assume that the embargo has been lifted now that it's been presented here at the briefing?
I see Ricardo nodding and WFP confirms. Yeah, so you can go ahead, but you will get the material as soon as it is issued in a few minutes. So thank you very much. Thanks to all colleagues for the presentation of this very important report. The numbers are staggering, really impressive. And I wish you all the best for your launch now in a few minutes of the report and event. Thank you so much. Let me now go to the Middle East. We have several speakers who will tell us about the situation in various countries in the Middle East, and I'd like to start with WHO. Tariq has brought us Dr. Reinhild van der Weert, WHO representative for the OPT. I'll give you the floor in a moment, Tariq, and to Dr. Reinhilde. Tommaso is here with Christian Cortes Cardoza, the IFRC Deputy Regional Director for MENA, who's speaking from Beirut about his recent mission to Iran. And then Tamin here in the room will give us a UN report on deaths and displacement in Lebanon. So let's start with WHO. Tariq, can you introduce your new colleague, please?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alessandra. And it's really a pleasure to introduce our new representative for the occupied Palestinian territories, Dr. René van der Werdt, who joined the OPT team in January, succeeding to Dr. Rick Pieperkorn, that you remember very well. Now, Dr. René is bringing really extensive experience in global health, in emergency management, in maternal and child health. She worked in many, many countries. I can't really now list them all, but she worked with MSF. She also worked with UNFPA. She worked with UNICEF. And she is back to WHO since 2017, while she also worked with us previously in a polio program. So extensive experience, and we are really happy to have her. This is her first time to speak to you here at Palais. And I'm just giving her the floor to tell us more about what's happening right now in Gaza.
Thank you very much.
Sarah.
Thank you very much, René. Welcome. And you are calling in from Jerusalem. Thank you.
Exactly. Thank you. And just making sure that you can hear me okay in Geneva.
We can, and we can see you well. Please go ahead.
Brilliant. Thank you. So as my colleague Tariq said, thank you for having me. This is my first time at the Palais. And indeed, I took on my function as the WHO representative to the occupied Palestinian territory in January. Since then, I've had the pleasure, if that is the right word, to visit the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. Seeing firsthand the scale and complexity of the challenges that Palestinians are living through and the extraordinary resilience with which they face them has been generally humbling. I just spent my first week in Gaza earlier this month, and really nothing prepares you for the scale of the destruction. You can read the reports, study the numbers, but standing in the streets in the middle of endless meters high piles of rubble is something else entirely. Most Palestinian families in Gaza remain displaced. They live in tents amidst the rubble, dependent on humanitarian assistance for the most basic of their needs. And despite the ceasefire, airstrikes, shelling, and gunfire continued. On April 6, as I was leaving Gaza, I was informed that a driver contracted by WHO to transport my colleagues between the different locations in the strip was killed. As a manager, as a mother, as a human being, having someone being killed on my watch was extremely difficult to process and manage, and as it was for the entire team. This incident and many others are the stark reminder that Gaza remains unsafe, regardless of the ongoing security reassurances. But despite the horrific conditions, what struck me just as forcefully are the people of Gaza. My WHO colleagues, the directors from the hospitals, the nurses, the doctors, the humanitarian workers, they stay positive. They find ingenious way around impossible constraints. They continue to deliver care for their communities day after day. And that contradiction, devastation, and determination existing side by side is something I won't forget. And it's honestly unlike anything I've seen in my more than 30 years of humanitarian work. I hope you have all seen the Gaza Rapid Damage and Needs Assessment, which was conducted by the World Bank, the European Union, and the United Nations, and which was just published. It puts the devastation in Gaza in perspective, and the numbers are astounding. Damages to the health sector alone are estimated at $1.4 billion. More than 1,800 health facilities are partially or completely destroyed. And it ranges from big hospitals like Al-Shifa in Gaza City to smaller primary healthcare centers, clinics, pharmacies, and laboratories. Total recovery needs for the health sector in Gaza are estimated at $10 billion over 5 years. This includes reconstruction, restoring health services, managing increased health needs. And this includes, in particular, the thousands of children and people that live with the consequences of this war. Children that are paralyzed from gunshot wounds, amputations, and just immense mental health needs.
The destruction in Gaza is not only devastating the health system and increasing the needs that need to be addressed, it is also generating unfortunate new health issues. The environment in which people in Gaza live is just unacceptable. Destroyed buildings and mountains of accumulated waste have created ideal breeding grounds for rodents and pests. Families are living in severely overcrowded tents, makeshift shelters, surrounded by debris, with limited access to water and sanitation services. A rapid assessment by the site management cluster in March of this year covered more than 1,600 displacement sites, found that 80% of these sites have frequent, visible rodent and pest presence. It affects more than 1.5 million people. Over 80% of these displacement sites report skin infections, such as rabies, lice, and bedbugs. And according to our health partners, more than 17,000 cases of rodent and what we call ectoparasitic infections have been reported so far in 2026. And this is just the unfortunate but predictable consequence when people live in a collapsed living environment. Supplies are being deployed, but pest control measures need to be brought in at scale. For WHO and the health partners, we need to have a better understanding on the diseases that are affecting the people in Gaza. We therefore need laboratory equipment and supplies to enter Gaza. As many of you know, those equipment and supplies do not enter Gaza, which leaves us blind with all the living conditions that I have just mentioned. And of course, the rubble needs to be removed, the water, the sanitation infrastructure needs to be restored, and waste needs to be managed. But despite these enormous challenges, efforts to boost the health system in Gaza are moving forward. And one of the last milestones I was really happy to see, as WHO, we completed a 128-bed extension at Al-Shifa Hospital. This is meaningfully increasing its inpatient capacity. However, for saving life to have an impact, things need to change. Health and healthcare workers need to be protected. Essential medicines and supplies must enter Gaza. Bureaucratic processes and access restrictions on these globally recognized essential medicines and supplies must be removed. Spare parts for medical equipment and generators need to enter. I was at Nasser Hospital, where the generator is in urgent need of repair. A breakdown of these generators that provide life-saving connections to this hospital will have fatal consequences. And bringing in more medical supplies also reduces the reliance on complicated medical evacuations from the strip. If patients need to be referred for specialized care, they need to be treated in hospitals in the West Bank, including Jerusalem. WHO and all our amazing partners remain fully committed to supporting Gaza, but we need the conditions and the environment that will allow us to scale up further, to move beyond immediate response, and to begin addressing the longer health needs. Without these, even the most dedicated response will fall short of what the people in Gaza need and deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this very extensive briefing. I'll open the floor to questions now in the room first. Nina Larsson, AFP.
Yes, thank you very much for the briefing, and very nice to see you. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about medical evacuations. How are they going, and what are the conditions for access there? And also on unexploded explosive ordnance in Gaza, we were just hearing that it's completely littered, obviously. Could you say a little bit about what kind of impact, health impacts you're seeing from that? Thank you.
René? Go
Thank
ahead.
You. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Because there was an issue with the unmute. Thank you for your questions. And the unexploded devices, I'll let experts talk about it, but we do indeed continue to see patients in hospitals that need trauma care. Of course, the numbers have reduced, but the cases are still there. What we call mass casualty incidents, they occur on a weekly basis in Gaza as we speak. Thank you for asking the question on the medical evacuations. This is a very, very complicated and complex process from a security point of view, from a logistics point of view, but first and foremost, from a patient's rights point of view. Patients, I suppose many of you in the room have family, patients and their families have the right to be treated where they live. That means medical supplies need to enter Gaza. A proportion of the patients that we currently transport to other countries can and should be treated in Gaza. In addition, before the war, patients would leave Gaza and be treated in hospitals in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. That referral needs to be open. And then, of course, we thank all the countries that have been generous in supporting patients that will need specialized care to leave Gaza. But the conditions on these crossings are dangerous, they are complex and complicated. So the more we can reduce the need and the reliance on medical evacuations and ensure people are treated where they should be treated, the better it is for the Palestinians that we have in Israel.
Indeed, thank you. You have a follow-up? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. On the medical evacuations, I was wondering, do you have the latest numbers of how many you've managed to do, and also what are the restrictions that you're still seeing at the to be able to evacuate people who actually need urgent and significant care outside, and also are they able to go to the West Bank or as they did previously, or is this all going out through Egypt and to other countries? Thank you.
Rini?
Thank you. So the West Bank referral is not open. Patients cannot leave Gaza to go to hospitals in East Jerusalem, where I'm sitting, or in the West Bank. So patients leave via the famous Rafah crossing, going into Egypt, and perhaps from there onwards to other countries, and now recently also back to Jordan. So the last medical evacuation happened on the 23rd of April via the Rafah crossing. This includes 47 patients with what we call 86 companions, because you can imagine these patients are critically, critically ill. So since October 23, we have, in support, of course, to the Health Ministry of Health, evacuated more than 11,000 patients, about 6,000 children, and more than 13,000 what we call accompanies. But unfortunately, since the critical incident that I mentioned, when somebody who worked for WHO got killed, unfortunately, the armored vehicles that we need to be protected so that we can safely make sure that patients can leave Gaza, they have not been arriving yet. So the road conditions need to improve. It's very, very tricky to, as you can imagine, we leave in one armored vehicle, then you have ambulances with patients, then you have a bus with the people that accompany, and then you have another armored vehicle behind it. We just need more security for our own staff to be able to make sure that we make sure that these patients leave. And again, anything we can do collectively to make sure that the referrals to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem open, are much appreciated.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up. So I'd like to thank you very much, René, for your first briefing here with us. I hope you will come back regularly to update us on the situation of health in the occupied Palestinian territories, in particular in Gaza. I'd like now to go to my right, to Tommaso Della Longa, who brought us Christian Cortez Cardoza, as I said, the FRC Deputy Regional Director for MENA region. Sir, you're speaking from Beirut, I understand, on your recent mission to Iran. Please.
Yes, good morning from Beirut. I have just arrived back from a 4-day mission to Iran, where I saw for myself the scale of the humanitarian need, the capacity of the Iranian Red Crescent National Society, and key challenge handling humanitarian assistance. I want to start with a simple but important point. A ceasefire does not mean the conflict is over. The announcement of a ceasefire early this month was a welcome relief. The reality on the ground, however, is very different. The impact of weeks of intense conflict is deeper than what headlines suggest. The consequences are still unfolding and will continue to be felt by Iranian society for months and years to come. Hundreds of health facilities, business, and educational institutions have been damaged or destroyed. There are growing concerns about access to specialized medical equipment and supplies, such as dialysis machines, as well as prosthetic devices, particularly where factories and supply chains have been disrupted. I visited the Iranian Red Crescent factory that produces and supplies 60% of the country dialysis filters and supplies and equipment. And due to the conflict, the raw materials required to continue to manufacture these filters are only available for the next 3 months. That is not just strategies, it is a countdown. At the same time, what stands out is the extraordinary capacity and reach of the Iranian Red Crescent Society. Their presence at community level across the country is remarkable. With 7,000 halal houses, which are Red Crescent community centers, they provide services ranging from psychosocial support, first aid, and support for shelter and livelihood for those in need, and are widely respected across the country. While they are well-trained to deal with disasters, the team had to quickly adapt to a completely different type of emergency. I heard repeatedly about response time being on average just 4 minutes after a strike. Teams arriving rapidly to carry out search and rescue, provide emergency care and support for families in distress. During the conflict, they were also able to respond to 7 million hotline calls to provide psychosocial support. Behind these efforts are ordinary people working under immense strain, while risking their own lives to save others. I was particularly struck by conversation with rescue teams, knowing the risk of the recent operating environment, one marked by constant insecurity and the fear of double tap attacks on the same site and rescue mission began. We met the rescue team that arrived at the site where one volunteer had been killed. The team had been due to change shift, but this was not possible. One colleague lost their life and several others were injured. It was very difficult to hear their account. Our women and men must be respected and protected at all times. Tragically, we have recently seen the loss of 4 volunteers with 18 others injured while responding to help those affected. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society is scaling up its support. This includes a revised emergency appeal of 120 million CHF to serve 10 million people, meet increasing needs, and enable practical steps to overcome access challenges, such as the recent cross-border delivery of critical medical supplies into Iran in partnership with the Turkish Red Crescent. Currently, it is only funded at less than 4%. This is a critical moment. Vital funding must be ensured so that organizations on the ground can continue their life-saving work and help communities begin the process of rebuilding their life. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thomas, do you want to add anything? No? So let me immediately go to questions. First of all, in the room, I don't see hands up. So Olivia Le Poitvin, Reuters.
Thank you. Thanks again for this briefing. Just a question. You were saying that about concerns about access to specialised medical equipment, and I think you pointed out about the dialysis machines. Could you just explain exactly what the impact therefore would be in terms of you're concerned about supply, but I mean, what would that mean for people trying to access that care on the ground? Are some people having to be turned away or appointments being delayed for treatment, or are we not quite at that stage? Is that something you're foreseeing if the situation were to continue in the next months?
Could I may?
Christian, yes, go ahead, please. We can hear you.
Yes. Yeah, thank you so much. I will give you an example. We will be sitting in the Iranian Red Crescent factory that produces 60% of the dialysis filters. The country needs 1 billion filters per year, and the National Society is able to provide 600 million of these filters. Unfortunately, the factories that produce the raw material were damaged or destroyed. And considering the situation, the Iranian Red Crescent only can continue producing for the next 2 to 3 months. So meaning that after 2 to 3 months, we will have 60% of the people that need dialysis without these supplies.
Thank you very much. Is there any other question for our colleagues of IFR? See, I don't see any. So thanks a lot, Christian, for coming and reporting on this mission to Iran. Thanks, Tommaso. Thank you very much. I'm sure you'll send the notes already. So I'll stay in the Middle East and go to Tamin, to my left. Mm-hmm. Tamin, you have a report on the death and displacement in Lebanon.
Yes.
Thank you. Please.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Alessandra. A UN Human Rights report published today on deaths and displacement in Lebanon during the first 3 weeks of the recent escalation of hostilities between Hezbollah and the Israeli military documents the significant ongoing impact on a wide range of human rights. These include the rights to life, health, education, food, housing, work, a safe environment, freedom of movement, and freedom of religion or belief. Our analysis of the large-scale attacks, shelling, and ground incursions found that operations by Israeli forces in Lebanon involved cases of direct attacks on civilians, including medical personnel. We also documented several incidents in which Israeli strikes hit and in some cases leveled multi-story residential buildings, killing entire families. Such strikes may constitute serious violations of international humanitarian law. Similar incidents have continued beyond this period, even after the present ceasefire was announced. Hezbollah fired reportedly unguided rockets into residential areas in Israel, damaging buildings and other civilian infrastructure. These strikes may also constitute serious violations of international humanitarian law. In many of the Israeli strikes, no warnings or no reasonably effective warnings were given, preventing many civilians from evacuating safely. Israel's vaguely communicated blanket evacuation warnings and displacement orders, covering almost 14% of Lebanon's territory, have led to the displacement of over 1 million people, according to the Lebanese authorities. Given the breadth and circumstances of these orders, they may amount to forced displacement, prohibited under international humanitarian law. 55 localities in southern Lebanon near the border with Israel remain under such orders today. All displaced civilians who wish to return to their homes must be able to do so safely. We have continued to document frequent deadly attacks on healthcare workers, particularly first responders, and on journalists. On Wednesday, an Israeli strike killed Lebanese journalist Amal Khalil in the south and injured photographer Zainab Faraj. Rescue teams, including the Lebanese Red Cross attempting to reach them, reportedly faced obstruction by the Israeli military. This included the use of a sound grenade and live fire targeting an ambulance, delaying access to the site. Medical personnel, whether military or civilians, and other civilians, including journalists, are protected under international humanitarian law. Deliberately targeting them would amount to a war crime. Civilian objects, including health facilities, schools, and religious sites, have been entirely destroyed or severely damaged. Israeli attacks have burned or contaminated farmland and disrupted or destroyed livelihoods, undermining the rights to food, work, and to a healthy environment. There have been reports that the Israeli forces have used ammunition containing white phosphorus, which has particularly incendiary effects. We are concerned about rising communal tensions and discriminatory practices preventing displaced people from accessing housing and other essential services. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk calls for prompt, thorough, independent, and impartial investigations into all incidents involving allegations of violations of international humanitarian law. Findings must be disclosed, and those responsible held to account. We urge all states to cease the sale, transfer, and diversion to any party of arms, munitions, and other military equipment where there is a clear risk that they could be used to commit or facilitate the commission of serious violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law. We also call on all parties to ensure the ceasefire becomes a permanent cessation of hostilities and basis for a lasting peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tamin, for this important report. Let me see if there are questions in the room. Mohammed?
Tamin, thank you so much for the briefing. As you mentioned, the journalist Amal Khalil was killed in the recent attack in Lebanon. As you remember well, we witnessed a similar situation in Gaza, where over 200 journalists were killed since 7 October. These people are just trying to do their job over there in Lebanon and Gaza. My question is, what is your call to countries and the international communities to prevent Israel from deliberately killing journalists?
Thank you for that, Mohammed. Obviously, as I said, this incident where Amal Khalil was killed yesterday and photographer Zainab Faraj is horrible. And we echo the Secretary General's condemnation of this. The situation for journalists and media workers have been horrible, whether in Lebanon or, as you said, in Gaza. We have reports that some 290 media workers have been killed in Gaza since the 7th of October 2023. The figures of the Lebanese government say that 27 journalists were killed in Lebanon also over the course of this conflict since 2023. These people are our eyes and ears on the ground. International humanitarian law requires that parties to an armed conflict take all necessary measures to minimize the impact of military operations on civilians, which includes journalists and media workers. In war zones, journalists and media workers perform a particularly vital function by informing the public about what's happening and By doing so, they highlight the impact of the violence on civilians and the humanitarian and other protection needs for civilians. They promote compliance with the international law rules and the application of these rules, and they support accountability by documenting violations. This is why they must be protected, and there must be accountability for all incidents where they are targeted. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let me Let me reiterate the condemnation of this, the killing of this Lebanese journalist expressed yesterday by the spokesperson of the Secretary General. We do condemn this killing. We extend our condolences to the family, friends, and colleagues of Amal, and we express our hopes for a full and swift recovery of the second journalist injured in the same incident. And let me see if that... Yes, Antonio, Efe?
Thank you. Good morning. So, Tamin, you mentioned that the attacks on journalists and healthcare workers could amount to war crimes. But what about the rest? These attacks on residential homes, the forced displacement, this could be also considered war crimes, for example, if they are proved that they are deliberate or other crimes that you mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Definitely these incidents are very much concerning because we have seen many attacks that occurred in residential areas on civilian infrastructure and many cases where civilians have lost their lives. And that is why we are calling for prompt, independent, and impartial investigations into all these incidents to determine which how international law can qualify them and which measures of accountability are needed. But of course, accountability here is paramount. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't know this was good. So thank you very much again, Tamin, for this important report and briefing. Let's now go to IOM. Zoe, you brought us Brian Kelly, who is the IOM Somalia Senior Program Coordinator. He's speaking from Nairobi, if I understand well. Do you want to start, or we go directly to Brian?
Yes, I believe that Brian should be online, so we can go directly to him.
He is. I've seen him. Yeah, we can see him, and hopefully we can hear him. Brian, welcome. I give you the floor for your remarks. Thanks.
Thank you. Good day. Bonjour. Just checking. Everyone can hear me?
I can hear you very well. Go ahead.
Thank you. So today I'm talking about Somalia and the drought. Somalia is facing a worsening drought crisis, and new IOM data shows that nearly 62,000 people have been displaced by drought since the beginning of this year, just within five districts in Somalia. We think that the total figure would be around 300,000, but we only have the data for the five districts as of today. In that area, drought now accounts for three out of every four new displacements within that section of Somalia. At the same time, 6.5 million people, that's almost one out of every three in the country, are facing high levels of hunger, while more than 1.8 million children are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition this year. You know, these figures point to a rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation. In the hardest hit areas, drought is driving crop failure, livestock losses, and water shortages, forcing families to leave their homes in search of assistance. Many are moving to urban areas in displacement sites that are already overstretched, where access to shelter, water, and basic services remains limited. families are arriving in places like Mogadishu and Baidoa, which can't support them, arriving often after their water has run out, crops have shriveled, and livestock have died. While rural to urban migration is as old as time, this forced displacement is affecting the most vulnerable. Health facilities in affected areas are also seeing rising cases of malnutrition, particularly among children. They've also become gathering points, as they're quite often the only places with access to water. For example, a story about Ido from Baroma District, she used to receive water deliveries to her village, but since they stopped, she now walks 5 kilometers to the nearest clinic to access water. Asha, who's 15 kilometers away from the same clinic, has made the five journey 5 times over the past month. Without rain, she says, crops can't grow, and families are left sharing what little they have. Safiya, who spoke at an IOM protection center in Baidoa, was forced to leave her village when water trucking stopped. The nearest shallow well is nearly 3 hours away, and women along the route face serious safety risks. You know, unfortunately, stories like these are becoming increasingly common as more families are forced to move, and conditions may worsen. IOM projections indicate that drought-related displacement of approximately 125,000 more people between April and the end of June, despite some forecasts of rainfall. You know, and IOM and partners were responding with emergency support, including shelter, water, essential assistance for newly displaced families, but the needs are rising faster than available resources. Collectively, UN agencies and NGO partners have only received 14% of the total appeal for 2026 for humanitarian funding. To respond to the absolute most vulnerable, IOM, we recently concluded a hyper-prioritization of needs and are urgently seeking $10 million to save lives and provide a basic level of dignity to the most vulnerable. That amount will not address all needs. It'll deliver critical life-saving support to those most at risk and help expand data collection in other severely affected areas beyond the 5 districts. You know, really what is needed now is urgent support for life-saving assistance alongside greater investment in drought resilience and measures that help communities withstand future shocks. Without swift action, drought will continue to drive displacement in Somalia, as well as hunger and vulnerability growing in the country. So thank you for your time, and appreciate the opportunity to discuss the critical needs in Somalia.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brian, for this briefing. Thanks for all this data information. Let me open the floor to questions, if any. Don't see hands up in the room, but Olivia Le Poitvin, Reuters, has a question online. Please, Olivia.
Thank you very much, Brian. Just a question in terms of that you've outlined there, that the kind of increasing number of people being displaced as a result of the drought. I'm just wondering about the other side in terms of then kind of providing help and aid to those people. I'm just wondering, given the context that we were in with ongoing supply chain issues caused by the Strait of Hormuz and wider war in the region, what issues you're seeing there in terms of then being able to bring in the kind of supplies and aid to help those people who are suffering drought, who are being displaced and are obviously in need of fresh shelter, water, food, etc.
Brian?
Yeah, thank you, Olivia. I didn't hear the exact beginning of your question, but I think I got the gist of it. Please let me try to respond and let me know if I didn't answer your question. Supplies have become restricted for all of the reasons that you have mentioned. Some specific data that I have is that, you know, rising inflation, it's estimated at around 6% in early 2026, But this is with sharp increases in fuel prices due to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And it's compounding the impact of drought and reducing the household ability to cope. Fuel prices have more than doubled from around 60 US cents per liter to $1.50 per liter in Mogadishu. And that, of course, drives up the cost of food, water, and transport, and accelerating displacement. So that's the specific information I have on that topic. I hope that answers your question to the best that I can, Olivia. Over.
Thank you very much. And she hasn't raised her hand again, so I guess it was a good answer. Nina Larsson, AFP.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for the briefing. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you guys reached the estimate of the 300,000 number, and also on the 10 million that you're seeking, what time frame are you seeking that for, and how much have you received? And if you could say what the impact will be if you do not receive the money you're seeking. Thank you.
Thanks, Nina. Brian?
Super. Thank you for that question, Nina. So we have our overall stock figures for displacement in the country, and then we had looked at the percentage which had been attributed to drought, and that was approximately, and I'll get back to you if the number, it's either 43% or 47% as far as the percentage that were attributed to drought. And then we had extrapolated that to other drought affected areas within the country. So it's that 300,000, it's an imperfect number, which is why the only number that we can say with surety is the 62,000, which is for the five districts. And for the 10 million, we have our broader HNRP, which is the interagency prioritization of humanitarian need, and within that, of course, IOM is represented. What we looked at within that document are what are the greatest priorities that we have that we would like to see most immediately addressed. And that focuses on data collection, because we do want to expand it beyond those five districts, as well as site management, where we're working in 617 different IDP displacement sites throughout the country, as well as some water sanitation hygiene programming and NFI kits. In the impact that of not being able to receive the funding, it just means that the coverage is going to continue to remain extremely low, including for the most vulnerable. We work closely with partners within the UN, within international and local NGO members, and so we look at the gaps that still remain, including the contributions of many of these other very good organizations, and then based upon that, we tried to identify the highest need and highest priority that we knew we could quickly address within a 6-month period, which I think was another part of your question, and that's how we came up with that figure. And I know that there's a document that either has been released or will be shortly released that gives more detail on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up for you for IOM. So thank you very much, Zoe, and thanks, Brian, for reaching out to our press. Thanks again. And now let me go to my left. Claire, welcome. You have brought us Wilfran Mufuna Okia. Welcome, sir. You are the head of climate prediction at WMO, and that is about the El Niño. Please.
Yes, good morning, everybody. This is a word I think you'll be hearing much more of in the coming months. The World Meteorological Organization has this morning issued an update saying that an El Nino event is expected to develop from mid-2026. As we know, El Nino has a major impact on rainfall patterns, on temperature patterns, and tends to increase global temperatures. This is based on the latest monthly global seasonal climate update. It's a monthly report that we issue, and it's ahead of a fuller, more comprehensive El Nino update, which we expect to issue at the end of May. But you know, as my colleague will shortly explain, we are seeing a clear shift in the equatorial Pacific. Sea surface temperatures are rising rapidly, and this is pointing to a likely return of El Nino conditions as early as May to July of this year. So, without further ado, I will pass. This news item, it's now on our website, and we have translations in French and in Spanish for those who are interested. Thank you. Wolfram.
Good morning, everyone, from Geneva. So our latest update by the World Meteorological Organization signaled the return of an El Niño event. This is marked with a shift toward a warmer surface temperature near the equatorial Pacific, and this will have an impact on the global temperature, but also it will reshape the rainfall pattern worldwide. So traditionally with El Nino, although every El Nino is unique in terms of impact and pattern, we have some commonality. So in general, with El Nino, we tend to see in some part of the world some excessive rainfall, for example, the Greater Horn of Africa, the southern part of South America, Argentina. And on the contrary, we also have large region where we see drought condition. An example could be a large part of Australia, Indonesia, Southeast Asia. What we are saying is that the El Nino is likely to happen, and this event will be strong. Now, the magnitude of the event is still uncertain because we are facing a phenomenon we call the spring predictability barrier, which is a kind of natural way which hampers our ability to anticipate the evolution of the magnitude of El Nino through spring. But when we will have our next update, we are likely to refine the magnitude of the event, and we can provide the policymaker, the decision maker, the humanitarian community with more credible or refined information about the El Nino impact. One thing to say also is that El Nino also lead to a spike in the global temperature. If we remember the year 2024, which is in our record, the warmest year on record, this year followed an El Nino event, and the temperature at that time was up to 1.55 degrees. What we are expecting is that in 2027, we will have high temperature, and depending on the intensity of the El Nino event, we might reach or breach temporarily the 1.5 like we did in 2024. Pause here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both. Let me see. I see that Christian Ulrich, German News Agency, has a question.
Yes, hello. Normally you give a percentage of... how do I explain that? Normally you say with a percentage of 60, 70, 40%, you expect the El Nino to develop in a certain time frame. Does that exist with this prediction also? And if I understood correctly, you said it will be strong. What are the indications today that make you say it will be strong? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. So first of all, regarding the strength of the event, so the tool underpinning our report, which are a model, all the group involved in producing the model, their forecast show a strengthening of the El Nino event at the end of the year. So from the model side. The second question you raise is the percentage we are providing. Actually, the percentage we are providing will happen at the end of next month because this is a temporary or intermediate report where we didn't provide all the statistics. But in May, we will have all the probability or the chances for El Nino to happen. But what is clear from the different tool is that the event will be strong.
Is that okay, Christian?
I don't quite understand from the forecasting tool. Is that based on the temperatures that are being measured now? Or what exactly gives you the confidence to say it's going to be strong? What are the indicators today?
Yes. So thank you. So basically, the model, the tool used for predicting the El Nino, have some metrics. One of them is the anomaly of temperature. So the model will calculate that value. So the different model calculating the value are high. Now, the one thing we need to bear in mind is that usually at this time of the year, in spring, it's very difficult to have confidence. So that's why we are waiting for May to come up with a clear picture, because although the model are indicating high value, we don't know whether it will be 1.5, 2, and so forth. So, but again, we have to wait for the center to refine that information. I hope that helped clarify the situation. Thank you.
Olivia Lepondin, Reuters.
I think just to clarify, it's that the models, it's for sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific, so it's not land surface temperatures. Sorry, Olivia.
Hi there, morning all. Thank you for this explanation. I just noted we had some reporting that forecasts kind of predicting the strongest El Nino in a decade. And a couple of sightings of Japan's Weather Bureau, also some forecasts from China. Just would be helpful, I appreciate your point that you are wanting to wait until after April for a more certain prediction. But I'm just wondering, are those forecasts, I mean, do you share that potential concern that it could be the strongest in a decade? You said it would be strong, but just wondering to what extent you agree with that assessment that it could be actually the strongest in a decade.
Thank you for your question. So currently what we can say for certain is that the El Nino will be strong. The one thing we do at the World Meteorological Organization is to find a consensus statement. Our consensus, meaning the agreement of all the different players, will happen next month. So some of the centers have indicated this situation for very good reason, but what we are waiting is to have all the consensus, all the different, because with El Nino, we have different way of measuring the intensity, whether you locate it in a region close to El Nino, in the Pacific or somewhere else. And what we will do at the end of the month is to gather all the perspective and try to come up with a refined statement on the intensity. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So if I could just give a little bit of background on that. So when we issue the full El Nino update, it is quite a lengthy international process. It goes through, I don't know how many people contribute, but it's a very extensive process. It takes a couple of rounds of reiteration, you know, to make sure that we do get full consensus on the models and also expert opinion as well. So it's, you know, it's, that's why we only do it four times a year.
Okay. Antonio, Efe.
Just a comment, because usually this El Nino update is sent to us under embargo, but I think it was not the case this time. So please, if you can keep that good tradition next time, it help us a lot. Thank you.
Yes, point noted. When we issue the full update, we do, and that is when we sort of give the percentage likelihood, then we do send that under embargo. This was a product which we issued based on the monthly global seasonal climate outlook, and it was really in response to the media questions that we've been getting. This is really an interim update, and it is in response to, you know, to media questions and to, you know, reply to some of the questions that we are getting, but noted.
And the next one will be on the embargo then. Thank you very much. I don't see other questions for you, so let me thank you both very much for this briefing. I have just a couple of announcements very quickly on the Committee of the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which is examining this morning the review, finishing this morning the review of the report of Cuba. This was the last country to be examined under this session. And the committee will also have a meeting with state parties on Thursday, on the 30th of April from 3 to 6, while the Committee Against Torture will hold a public meeting devoted to the follow-up to Articles 19 and 22 of the Convention and the question of reprisals, and that will be on Monday at 4 p.m. at Palais Wilson. I wanted to draw your attention on the fact that the 11th Review Conference of the Parties to the Treaty of Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT as it is known, will meet at the United Nations headquarters from the 27th of April to the 22nd of May. The review conference will assess the implementation of the treaty since 2022 across its three pillars: nuclear disarmament, non-proliferation, and the peaceful use of nuclear energy. The conference will also seek to identify the areas and means through which further progress can be made. Our Office for Disarmament Affairs invites you to join a hybrid press briefing by Undersecretary General Izumi Nakamitsu that will be held in New York today at 1:15 p.m. in New York time. So that would be about, I think, 19 hours 15 in Geneva. This will be, of course, webcast on UN Web TV. Just for your information, the president of the conference, Ambassador Do Hung Viet, who is the permanent representative of the Social Republic of Vietnam to the UN in New York, will also hold a press conference, and that will be on the 27th at 2 p.m. New York time after the opening session, and that will be also on webcast. There are a number of meetings at this press conference, at this conference, which will be open, and they will be broadcast live on UN Web TV. There is a calendar there, a schedule, if you want to have a look on that. And otherwise, my last point is that, as you may remember, 24th of April is the International Day of Multilateralism and Diplomacy for Peace, something that we really need to stress in the current geopolitical context. And I wanted to call your attention to a video that our library and archive colleagues have put on today on their platform on multilateralism. So that is all I had for you. If there are no other questions, and I don't see any, I wish you a very, very good weekend, and I'll see you next week on Tuesday. Thank you.